Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. And today on the show, the amazing Kyle Gordon. Now, if you're on any form of social media, chances are you are familiar with Kyle Gordon's work. He is a hilarious comedian who, be it on TikTok or YouTube or any of these places, his stuff is viral, constantly viral. There's no other way to put it. This is someone that my kids are excited about being on the podcast. My neighbors very excited about Kyle coming on the podcast. My good buddy, Nick Woj, who co-hosts I Heard They Stream Live with me, is very excited about Kyle being on the podcast. And I tell you that these three subjects that I have mentioned have very little in common in terms of tastes. But that speaks to Kyle and sort of the reach of his work and his ability to kind of find the universal in all of these things that he's kind of parodying, poking fun at, satirizing, that just really seems to resonate with people of all ages and all walks of life. Now, Kyle does a lot of different types of comedy, but I think what he's become most known for is his parody songs, and that could be parodying new metal bands or parodying divorced dad rock or parodying early 2000s stomp clap indie rock, I guess, for lack of a better term, or all sorts of stuff. He is a very funny guy, a very prolific comedian, and someone who's got a lot of insight. And also one of the rare people that has hit me up to come on this show and stress right out of the gate that they are not necessarily a deep punk fan, but exclusively almost a Ramones fan. And this is where Kyle and I kind of bonded, is that we both were just down to talk about the Ramones and all sorts of other stuff. So anyway, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out Kyle's fantastic, hilarious new record. Kyle Gordon is wonderful. You can hear it everywhere now. Kyle just wrapped up a tour for this record, but he's got like one more show coming up in New York in September. You can find out more information on Kyle Gordon is great on IG. He's on TikTok. He's on YouTube. There'll be links in the description of this episode as well. And also, Kyle has just been announced as a special guest on not one, but two dates of the Kyle Mooney tour. That's right. Kyle Mooney, who was also just on the show. So how about that? They will be uniting not just on Turned Out of Punk, but in physical form as well, on July 17th in Philadelphia and July 20th in Washington, D.C. So go say hi to the Kyles and go check out those shows. Check out Kyle's record. Check out Kyle's stuff wherever you can find it. And that's it. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. You can reach me or the show's producer, Tristan Abraham, at turnedoutofpunkpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all forms of social media at turnedoutofpunk. And that's it. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Kyle Gordon on Turned Out a Punk. Kyle, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm psyched.
Well, I was just telling you off air, we were just kind of talking about it briefly, that Nick Woj, who hosts the Turned Out a Punk, I Heard They Stream Live podcast, or live stream with me. I was telling him that you were coming on the podcast, and I think out of any guest that was coming up, he was most excited about you coming on the show, which, as I was telling you, is a hard-won praise, because Nick is pretty grizzled.
Yeah, sounds like he must have terrible taste then. So yeah. Yeah, he just doesn't like cool things. So that's why he must be excited about me coming on. So no, yeah, that's awesome.
I'm always surprised by his takes. I'm always like, that really, this you don't like? It's always like, I never know how it's going to go, but I'm very excited to talk to you because I'm a fan of everything you do.
Thanks.
And I think, I don't know, like when we were talking on Instagram, and I asked you, like, did you grow up as a punk kid? You were very honest and said, not really, which is a breath of fresh air for me because normally I find that out halfway through the podcast with someone. So I'm glad you were just.
Yeah, I couldn't in good conscience call myself a punk kid in the same way of like I grew up in Westchester, which is like north of New York. If I were to call myself a New Yorker, I think I'd be like drawn and quartered. So like, yeah, like, you know, a lot of my taste is like revolves around and centers on punk, obviously, but to call myself a punk kid, I don't think I could do that. I wouldn't be able to sleep tonight if I did that.
It's funny because I would say more than any other group that have come on this podcast, because I'm like, you know, into 600 episodes now, I've noticed comedians are the ones that are the most kind of weary of calling themselves punk kids. David Cross, Michael Ian Black, like all of them gave this preamble before being like, no, I wasn't a punk kid, but you know, yeah. And then it turns out they do love it. And so it winds up being a great conversation, but it's interesting. There's like this sort of very.
Well, I think that's the weird thing about comedians is that we're also like the most self-conscious and the most susceptible to like embarrassment. So like it, like even like, You slip up in like one little like tiny fact and you're like, fuck, I'm a fucking idiot. Like, no, I'm not a fucking punk kid. God damn it. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's something punk has a lot in common with comedy then too, because everyone's just waiting for you to slip up on that one little punk fact and just jump all over you. So
Exactly.
I got to start this off though, the way that I'll start off, which is, Kyle, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it? I guess not, maybe more into the Ramones, because that was actually the band that you brought up.
Yeah.
And we'll get to why I found that really interesting in a second.
Yeah, I like the Ramones are like my A number one here. They're just the perfect band generally. But I would say I got into punk. I would say I'm mostly like my taste revolves around like 20th century, like rock and pop music and, you know, really pop. I think my taste is more like pop leaning generally. But then I've also always just been obsessed with since I was a little kid with genres in general and really needing to like deeply understand, like just dive deep into different genres. And so probably the first like, I remember on my iTunes, like needing to categorize everything perfectly. Like there was a genre column and I needed to like categorize everything. And I remember my punk section was the smallest, and I think it was just the Germs. Like in my mind, like the Germs were punk, and I was like, okay, I understand this now, I can move on to other things. But then as I got older and, you know, just kept learning and looking things up and reading and whatever and listening, probably is when I, like, you know, everyone, if you live on planet Earth, you have an ambient sense of the Ramones. If you've been to like a sports game, you know the Ramones. But then learn, like, it's that you know, experience of like digging deeper and like actually discovering the rest of their catalog, and then you realize it's so deep and so good. And I fell in love with the Ramones as like a pop group and like for the songwriting. And you know, there's a lot of things I love about them, but I think once I got into the Ramones, then I started, you know, getting into punk more generally and kind of also then you learn that like all these, you know, if you like British music, it's pretty much every band started off at, like George Michael started off in like a punk band. So like, you know, you kind of just start digging deeper and deeper and, you know, then I've been rambling, but that's kind of where it all started.
Well, I got to say, the Germs, if you're going to have one punk CD, I would definitely say the Germs is the one to have. Like that Germs discography that Warner Brothers, I think, /Warner Brothers put out, right, in the 90s?
Yeah. I think it would have been just like literally like a few MP3s on on iTunes. So, like, I think I literally just had Lexicon Devil, like, as like literally like one track, and I was like, okay, that's what punk is. Now I can like understand that's punk.
That is definitely the punk too, and also the birth of hardcore too. It's like this weird record that kind of breaks with it, because I'm kind of the same way as you. I'm always been fascinated by the genres and the way stuff intersects with each other and the way it kind of interacts with each other. And I knew you were a deep Ramones head when you said that the episodes that you were into from this podcast were Linda Ramones and Monty Melnick's, which I got to say are not two of the most popular episodes in the Turned Out of Punk catalog.
Well,
which...
it's just me and yeah. And a bunch of like elder Italian guys, like, or, you know, like you really have to dig deep. Yeah. Yeah, no, those, those were awesome. I actually, when I knew I was going to do this, I was re-listening to the Monty Melnick episode, which is so fun. You learn so much from that episode. So yeah, I'm like, yeah.
I think the Ramones to me are such an interesting band, because at first blush, they're just so simple. And that's what everyone's, you know, says. It's almost cliche. It's almost cliche now to point out this,
right?
But they're actually so much more complicated musically. But then everything about it, the fact that here's these guys that put on basically a persona that Johnny gave them, you know, all these years ago, and then were expected to carry it for the rest of their lives. And that's what Joey did, and certainly what Johnny kind of did. But you look at the people that kind of came in and out of this thing, it seems more like a military service. CJ, the way CJ described
it. Yes. Right. Exactly. Well, you have your standard issued uniform, and you, like, you know, you get a haircut. You have to do it like you're joining the army. Yeah. I mean, it's like, yeah, the whole thing is so fascinating to me. And I was thinking about it, like, too. Like, what I love so much about them as, like, there's a lot, but, you know, they came around too at a time that is so fascinating, in that, like, they were the first generation to have essentially never known a world without rock music. So they are able to be both. They're both the, I mean, also it's been talked about, but like, they are both the future. Like, every, like, that's a line in the sand. Like, the Ramones came and everything was different after then. But also they are a reflection and like a postmodern reimagining of everything that came before them. And like, that era that started in the mid 70s, like, they are both paving the way forward and stripping everything back. But they're also like, you know, I was thinking about, like, the Ramones are, you know, like, they're like Neil Sedaka, like, they're Brill Building, like, pop, just left of center and kind of fucked up, like, you know. And that's the kind of stuff that always drew me to them, was the songwriting and the fact that, what people say, it's like simple. That doesn't mean it's easy or anyone can do it. It just means you've just stripped it back to the essence. And like, you know, it's like, if you took any great rock song or pop song, no matter how complex it is, if you just strip it back, you just, that's where you like reveal and unveil just the quality of the songwriting. And it's like, you just know how good of songwriters Dee Dee and Joey are, just by that they are able to create enduring melodies with the barest of tools.
Yeah. And they're also, it's interesting, their relationship with kind of comedy, because they are postmodern in that way. They're almost parody proof. Like, they're, yes, they're always in on the joke in a way you couldn't see, like, Led Zeppelin be in on the joke if they were on The Simpsons and they're like, kill the Rolling Stones, like, yeah, you know, yeah. Or like, or Gilbert Godfrey doing that sketch with them as the other member. Like, afterwards, it makes sense, bands kind of being in on the joke. But like, prior to that, rock and roll is like very serious, or it's Dr. Demento and it's funny. It's never like the two.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Demento is a great, like, the Ramones are, I don't know. I don't know if Dr. Demento ever played. He did.
He was one of the first guys to kind of get on board with it. Cause it was like, you know, you see these interviews with these old time radio DJs and they were like, I thought it was a fucking joke. Like, I threw the record off the turntable.
And like... Right. Right. Well, it's funny. Like, it is like funny. But like, I wouldn't say it's like comedy per se, but it's like the music and the lyrics and the concepts are funny. Like, in addition to them being oftentimes like inadvertently hilarious, but like, you know, the whole thing is, and sort of like that postmodern, almost like self-awareness is, yeah, like people have asked me to do, or like if I'm going to do a Ramones parody, I'm like, one, I feel like I'm too close to it. And two, it's like, yeah, I agree. Like what's like, yeah, it's already self-aware. So it's like almost like the comedy becomes incestuous. Like you're making a joke about a joke, you know?
Yeah. Like it's almost like needs the earnestness of something for it to land. Because like, I had, Dan Burt from Chumbawamba on the podcast.
Oh, cool.
And one of the first things they ever put out was they got a song by a fake band that they made up called Skin Disease on an Oi compilation. And the song was called I'm a Wanker. So it's like, yeah, you know, there's this sort of like higher level kind of satire that they're doing. And then they're inceptioning it into Oi culture. But then it becomes, it's like a classic Oi song now. And like Oi people, if you put it on an Oi night, everyone would be singing along and dancing, yeah, unaware that it's a mocking thing because it gets internalized in a way. Like there's almost like this weird kind of parody proofing to punk in it at times, because it is kind of like so in on the joke. And like you're saying, it's never, it's not like, it's not comedy, but Jello Biafra, when he's saying kill the poor, that is comedy. That is funny.
Yeah, totally. 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 Yeah. And yeah, I think it's, yeah, it does. There does need to be a little bit of a lack of self-awareness, and like a total self-seriousness makes it more ripe for comedy. Like, what was the SCTV bit? The Queen.
Yeah. I hate the bloody Queen.
Yeah.
By the Queen haters.
The Queen haters. Yeah. Exactly. And so,
which is one of the best punk songs ever.
Well, there you go. And, exactly.
Yeah. And the band that played on it was a Toronto hardcore band that's unfortunately very much sort of forgotten to a lot of people, but this band, the Young Lions, were an actual punk hardcore band from Toronto that they brought in to do it. And according to the story that those guys tell, they finished playing the song and they're like, that was great, guys, but can you play it again shittier?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like, well, I mean, it's that, that's what I try, you know, at when I think at when I'm doing it right, what I try to do is like the thing of like, yes, it's like, you know, when I'm doing musical parodies or parodies of different genres, I both, you know, like I want to be able to identify certain like lyrical tropes, because that's where the comedy comes in. And like a lot of times there is like a self-seriousness to the source material. But like at the end of the day, like I love it when people tell me like you kind of have to squint in order to like see that it's a parody, or like to distinguish it from, or like when people tell me that like one of my songs gets played at like a nu metal night or a, you know, Eurodance night or whatever, like in the genre that I'm parodying, and it just gets slotted in right next to, you know, the source material, like that's the dream. Or like, so I have this like Eurodance, 90s Eurodance song. And like my favorite thing is people have told me like, yeah, I showed it to like my Romanian cousin and they were like, yeah, what? It's just like a good song. Like, I don't understand about that. What are you talking about? Like, that's just a song. Like, I don't understand.
Well, that's one thing. Until you like listen to the lyrics, a lot of times they are all really good songs that you're writing in their respective genres. Like this would be with different lyrics. And that's where I think punk makes it would make it hard, because like, you can't out ridiculous kill the poor in a lot of ways, but like the way you're pointing out how insane these lyrics were, especially to me, that nu metal parody hit home for me on a deep level, because I hated nu metal. And I know that you and me have different opinions. We're on different sides of the Limp Bizkit's cultural reassessment war.
Yeah, well, exactly. We're in the middle of it right now. We're in the eye of the storm right now. It's happening. Yeah.
And I felt that your song was amazing because it reminded people like, no, it don't let him play it off that it was some sort of Andy Kaufman higher level thing.
Yes.
It was sophomoric and it was kind of homophobic. And it was like everything that you had in your parody was like, as someone who lived through it, that's what it was. It wasn't this sort of like self-aware joke thing that's being kind of played by some of the people that made this stuff.
Totally. I mean, yes, him especially. Like, I think he, you know, he's a ridiculous person. It definitely, I mean, for the record, he was not joking. He was not joking when that stuff was happening. But, like, I think a lot of that stuff in retrospect, you know, and with 20 years remove is, I think it's really fun, really, like, saying something is stupid to me is not a pejorative like that, you know, like like it's like the it's really dumb, but it's really fun. I think Wes Borland is actually a great guitar player. I think a lot of those songs are really like, you know, I watched the Woodstock 99 documentary. One of my, I feel like weirdly, like one of my first memories in life was like watching MTV and learning about Woodstock 99. Like that's a thing that's been in my mind. And like, you know, watching the Woodstock 99 documentary, there were a few of them that came out, but one of them was like much more critical, I think, of like Limp Bizkit and that whole scene. And then you watch the documentary, I'm like, they put on a great show. Like they did what they were like, that they did what you paid them to do. Like they fucking went for it. Like, and yes, they were like, you know, douchebag, like cartoons, like, but like, I think now also like with this reevaluation, obviously it's being, you know, reassessed and like reclaimed by like a newer generation that is sort of stripping away all the like stupid macho bullshit of it and what the initial part was.
Yeah. It's an interesting time to reflect back upon. Cause I think you're right. Like that moment, and now they've made two documentaries about it. So I guess it has been, but they weirdly, the Tragically Hip, the Canadian, one of the few Canadian involvements.
I know that part in the documentary, I'm like, oh, these poor guys.
The one person's perspective I would love to hear, and he would probably never do a documentary about it, would be Zach De La Rocha. Cause I imagine, yeah. I imagine for him, it would be like, what the fuck was this for?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. They really don't. And well, that must have been the exact, like, yeah, that would be really interesting. It's funny you mentioned that. Cause like, yeah, like when you talk about bands whose lyrics have been wildly either ignored or misinterpreted, like Rage is like top of the list. Like when you get like, you know, Republican congressmen saying it's like their favorite song to like, you know, run to, you know, like, and so, yeah, like being there must have been, I don't know if it was the first time, but like must have been the peak of that dissonance between what they're giving and what the audience is taking in.
Yeah, like it's such an interesting thing because like the goal in music is to get as, and the goal I think in anything, entertainment, right, is to get as seen by as many people as possible. But then there hits a point, and I heard you bring this up on a podcast that I was listening to. It might've been the podcast where you're talking about Limp Bizkit actually, where you're going to hit a tipping point in your audience where you're not going to be able to control. It's not going to be all cool people that are going to get the vibe of the thing. And I imagine for him, it's like, man, like I made it as clear as I could to everybody what these songs were about.
Yeah.
But people can, you know, people can slip in the parody Eurodance song in the Eurodance night, and in the same way, people can mosh to the breakdown and have no idea what the words over top of it are about.
Right. And yeah, that's just like an inevitable part of like mass culture. Like, I mean, you don't even have to get to the level of Rage. Like you can be, you know, like a 10 times smaller band, and even just you get beyond your like local scene. As soon as that happens, you're not in control anymore. Like, and it's just sort of an inevitable part of it. And all you can do is just that's why I think too, it's a good lesson to like really try not, I think personally, like not try to pay attention, or like when you're creating, like try not to think about who the audience is or how it's going to be received, because that's when you get bogged down in the muck and it starts to get muddied in your own head, because it's a fruitless enterprise to like try to do that, I think.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, when he was on the podcast, he talked about this band and it goes somewhere, don't worry, but it's got a terrible name. White Pride was the name of the band, and it was like a a joke mocking white power band from St. Louis that he knew. And they had Asian members, they had Jewish members, and it was like very clearly a parody, but it's a stiff parody that years later it was bootlegged by a neo-Nazi label, and has subsequently they were asked to play a reunion festival at a neo-Nazi event and stuff. Like it's it got taken up by these people that weren't able to separate or weren't able to see it or were too dumb to see it, at least.
Yeah, I mean, that fucking sucks. Yeah, that really, really sucks. But yeah, I mean, but then like, then again, like something totally innocuous, like, you know, like whatever, Pepe the Frog, like was a totally innocuous internet cartoon that there was no way you could have predicted at the beginning that it would become like a Nazi symbol. And so, you know, you know, when you name your band White Power, you're, I guess it's more dangerous.
Yes,
like it's more dangerous, but like I don't necessarily like, you know, I haven't listened to White Power, but like I'm sure they like anyone with half a brain would, based on how you're describing them, would like be able to see the parody, and like trying to stay one step ahead of over like ahead of the like dumbest, biggest piece of shit people in the world is like, I don't know. I just think, you know, they're going to, I don't know if you can.
It's interesting at this point though, because in other times in history, like they were White Pride, by the way, not White Power. I should.
Why? Sorry. Sorry.
In case you want to look it up later on.
It is like, if we're talking about like notches, it's one tiny notch better.
We're talking about hairs on an ass, basically.
But
it is like, it is something that over time, as people lose the context of what you're doing something in place, they're not going to, it's going to be harder for them to kind of get it, you know. But I think also now we've moved into a place where at other times in history, like satire and they felt like they were like on the higher shelves in the intellectual bookstore. But now I think everything's just so readily available that these walls and sort of these protections and barriers that people had from this kind of information have fallen away.
Yeah. And it's something I think about too, in that, you know, exactly what you were saying, that because it's so readily available and it's accessible to anyone, something that I notice, especially with satire or parody, that I really try to avoid in my own work is like, you know, either you do something shitty or you do something either shitty, like you're expressing shitty ideas, or it's just a not of good quality. And then, you know, especially when you're doing comedy or satire, be like, I don't like the posture when it's like, oh, I was just kidding. You don't fucking get it. Like and sort of, I noticed this, it's a bad instinct that a lot of people can fall into, especially in like alternative comedy worlds. It's like either you get it and I'm a genius, or you don't get it and you're a fucking idiot. Either way, I'm right and you don't, like, you know what I mean? It's like taking the onus off yourself to like make better shit, you know, like, and that can work with like satire or parody, where it's just like, I really try to, you know, yeah, not just like insulate my, like be so high concept that you're insulating yourself from any audience like needing to like make something that's good, or, you know,
it's interesting though to like look at comedy, because it's also like, and you see it in music, it's just, I guess, nature of humans, where there's like sort of this cultural pendulum swinging at times. And it's interesting to look at like the Patton Oswalt era of a couple years ago of comedy versus sort of the Bert Kreischer era of comedy of now, where it's sort of like what is and isn't alternative comedy's change. Like it's just a marked difference from like an outsider observer, a fan observer type.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah. We're in a weird time right now, I think. Yeah. It's Yeah, I think there's like there's a lot of good that has come out of it in that, like, you know, it's very accessible, and like a lot of people talk about it in everything, like the gatekeepers have been stripped away. So it's like, you know, for someone like me, like, you know, which, you know, to go back to like punk and the Ramones and, you know, imbibing those lessons of like, all I needed was like a phone and a good idea. And I was not inhibited by anything, really. Like, I just, you know, sort of that DIY ethos is like now the norm, I think, in a lot of ways, in that just like there are so few barriers to entry. But yeah, then again, you know, the flip side is that is anyone can get an audience, like, you know, and so I'm not. Yeah, it's sort of this weird time where I don't really have an answer. I don't know what the.
Yeah, I don't know. There is an answer to that question. More just like a
yeah, 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 yeah. Exactly. Like, yeah. But yeah, it's yeah.
But it's like it's because I guess because comedy obviously is deeply rooted in punk rock, but I think in the same way, punk changed comedy, and certainly in the means of, you know, handling your own merchandise, going on the road, sleeping on couches, getting in the van. And I guess I'm sure there was always a circuit, comedy clubs that were franchised and you do that kind of stuff, but
right,
like it wasn't kind of in the same way that it felt like it was in the early 2000s and late 90s, I guess it really starts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, that whole ethos. Yeah, I mean, I would say like a David Cross or like you know, the State, you know, like though they all came from like the punk world and imbibed a lot of those lessons. I mean, I remember one of the first things I started doing comedy in like 2014, like moved to New York and was doing improv, and just like, you know, I just said, fuck it. Like, let's go on tour. No, but I had been doing comedy for like 6 months and I had this like alt comedy act with my friend, and we just were like, fuck, he was from Cincinnati. So we're like, all right, we'll do a tour of the Midwest. We like, no one showed up to any of these gigs, but like we stayed with friends and family. And like, I never would have had the like balls to do that, like, had it not been for like the philosophy of punk. I think that's the thing that's like in like literally had the biggest influence on me, is like punk as like a life philosophy of like, you know, because I think when I was really young, like it took a long time for me to get on stage because I was so self-conscious and so easily embarrassed. And so I was like, I'm not good enough to do this. Like, I need more practice. Like, I can't do like that. The concept of like actually performing in front of people was so terrifying to me. But then the idea of like, no, you'll get good by just getting up there and doing it. And also, all you need is like your taste and ideas, and that's more important than anything. And so like just having the balls to do that, like, absolutely came from like the punk philosophy.
Well, I think that's like also, yeah, like, 'cause that at the end of the day, musically, like, what is punk? And I certainly think there's like bands that you can take.
No one's
out.
Ever asked that question before, I think. So, yeah.
But like, I think where they fail is that they, it's everything, right? Like, my favorite, one of my favorite punk records ever is a bootleg of Davey and the Cool Marriage Counselors. And it's just him kind of singing, kind of creepily whispering about wandering through the underwear section at Sears.
Yeah.
And it's like, if that can be a punk song, then anything can be a punk song. And if that, and if anything can be a punk song, then anything can be anything. Like, you can kind of just go out and write your own ticket. And like, I think you see that. I don't think musically Odd Future was influenced by punk, but I think definitely like that approach influenced Odd Future. And I think that approach, certainly David Cross being involved in the kind of the punk scene and seeing that stuff influenced David Cross. I think RuPaul being involved in the punk scene and seeing that stuff influenced RuPaul. Like, I feel like that is the cultural thing from punk rock that changed the world.
Yeah. Totally. It's that approach. It's like a DIY approach. Like, and also it's like the idea too that has been really influential on me is just like not waiting for someone to pick me, you know, like to, it's just like going out and making your own stuff and like not asking for permission from anyone to do anything, or, you know, asking if, you know, like that freedom is like essential. And that's why, but that's why I think that that idea like can influence as, you know, disparate a group as, you know, Odd Future and RuPaul and David Cross and me, like, you know, it's a really, it's like the core of punk, but it can be applied to any medium, any anything. Like, it doesn't even have to be entertainment. You could, like, you know, you could be a punk rock dentist. That might not be a great idea, because you honestly, if you really wanted to, you could probably be like, just be like, I'm just gonna fucking figure it out myself, and then the gatekeepers of dentistry can't hold me back. I will discover new I'll do it in my basement.
It's funny you say that. There's a legendary rare punk records compilation called Killed by Dentistry that was put out by a dentist.
So, there you go. Fuck yeah.
He was punking up the dentistry world, you know. But yeah. I feel like you're right. Like, the Moderna vaccine was invented by some guy that was like a crazy punk rock record collector.
Really?
Too, apparently.
Oh, yeah. Word.
Well, there's an interview with him, and he brought it up to the interviewer, and the interview had no follow up to that. And I was like, oh my God, that would be my opening.
Yeah. That's, that needs to be, more, widely known.
Yeah. Yeah. The punk rock influence on us not having COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, maybe not. I don't, you talk about getting that in the wrong hands. Maybe, see like railing against.
There were a lot of actually anti, COVID vaccine punk rockers too. So I think the sword swung both ways on that one, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But that, to go back to the Ramones, like, that's baked in a punk rock's DNA. Like, I feel like punk rock, I think the Ramones are kind of like, maybe not the first punk band, but like the band that kind of like distilled it. And like you're saying, influenced everything that came after it. And in that way, you've got a Joey who was a lifelong Democrat, but like, you know, like whatever, on the lefter side of the spectrum. And then you've got Johnny, who was the KKK, who took the baby away.
Yeah, right.
And they're both in the same band, locked together, kind of in this forever sort of push and pull.
Well, actually, this is, yes. Well, that's why the Ramones, okay, separate from the music, which is just the best, them as four characters is like, they're like the Ninja Turtles. Like, each one is like a perfect character, like each one, like you had, yeah, Joey, the romantic, Dee Dee, the goofball, I guess.
Crazy,
like,
one, the wild card.
Yeah. Right. Like, Johnny, the like angry one. And then Tommy, the like, I don't know, the thinker. I don't know. But yeah, like
the one who was smart enough to get out right away.
I love the part in, the End of the Century documentary where Dee Dee thinks Tommy is smart. He's like, he could peel potatoes. Like, he knew how he could like peel potatoes. He knew how I just gather like potato chips. He could boil a potato.
the moment Dee Dee's cinematic career, although brief, has some incredible moments, like finding out that the band's called the Murder Junkies, not Gigi Allen in Hated.
Yeah.
And then him staring at Dino Sex as he's drumming naked.
Yes.
What the fuck am I
got into? I forgot about that. Oh my God, it's so good. Yeah. He was in that band for like, what, 45 minutes?
Like he quit on the way back from a show after someone tried to throw someone for the band. It's been a while since I've watched Hated. I'm due for my once in a while viewing of that.
Yeah, that'll
movie.
Be tonight. Yeah, it's a good reminder. But yeah, the influences of all of them like came through. It's like a perfect, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Like, it's such a cool, melding of all those things. I guess not to, so I, you meant the KKK took my baby away. Is that we? That's officially about Johnny.
That's apparently officially about Johnny.
And okay.
There's like the Ramones lore on this goes really deep, obviously, as you know. And yeah, like it is fascinating to kind of like start peeling away. Like Johnny, I think Fat Mike, when he was on the podcast, said that there's like a deleted chapter from Please Kill Me that was asked to be removed, all about just Johnny. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't nice.
Yeah. And that, like, just people talking about Johnny, or it was
just people talking about Johnny, just stories about Johnny.
Yeah.
And you kind of get that sense, even in Monty's book, like the beginning when they're talking about Johnny as this kid, as a sort of like street tough.
Oh, I mean I think there's a lot of holes left in that era of like, yeah, probably some extremely fucked up shit.
Yeah. Like, I think he was a pretty hard dude. And I feel like it's kind of like you're saying, it's perfect. Like, you've got this sort of like hard, tough guy. And then you've also got a like tender poet. But I think there's also like, there's complexities in that. Like, Joey would always send Johnny a Christmas card, Linda said on that episode. Right. And like,
yeah.
And when I met Johnny, like, he was one of the nicest people I'd met in music.
Yes, and I've heard that, and I believe that, too. Like, he's not – that's the thing. It's like, they both are cartoons, but then also no one's a cartoon. You know, like, like, so that totally checks out. And like, yeah, Johnny wasn't, like, a monster. Like, he was a really cool, good guy who also, like – you know, was so passionate and like defensive of the Ramones as a group and each of these people individually, no matter what happened between them.
So this is maybe this will be cut from the episode. Depends how brave I feel when it comes time to cut out. But there's this legend, and allegedly when Linda left Joey for Johnny, Joey allegedly had a group of people beat up Johnny and put him in hospital.
Really?
And allegedly Johnny found out and Joey went to visit him. And now this might just be my fantasy of how it went down.
That's not the, like, that's not like the beatdown.
Well, it was the, I guess
Johnny, when he like got his brain thing.
I might have been that one, actually. Whoa. Now that I'm putting it all together, and then allegedly whispered in Joey's ear, "I know what you did," or "I know it was you. The band's mine now." And that was when Johnny kind of took control of the band. Now, this is all maybe complete bullshit, wow, but I've heard this like over the years as sort of this like fable of what happened. And again, like, I don't know.
That's crazy. I mean, that, but like, it does sort of lead to the, you know, there's just so much mythology, like soap opera shit around the Ramones. It's crazy. Like, yeah, that's wild.
But it also, if that's true, and once again allegedly, and I've also only talked to Joey one time, he was super nice when I was a little kid. I saw him on the street and waved to him, and he waved back and said hey, and but like, that was it, my interaction with him. But it does add another wrinkle to sort of this, like, oh, one's the villain or one's the heel, one's the baby face.
Right. Well, it adds a wrinkle. Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, yeah, right. And that's what I even fall into that a little bit too, like, as being like, you know, sort of my taste leans more like poppy, and like, that's part of the stuff. A lot of the stuff I love for the Ramones are like the poppier, you know, Beach Boys, Frankie Avalon, fucked up, you know, type stuff that they do. And so I was always drawn to Joey, but like, it's not that complicated, and they're not, or no, sorry, it is more complicated. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, yeah. It's not that complicated. That's what I like. So shut the fuck up. Okay. It's more complicated than that. Like,
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because we know in making the most of your home, DIY doesn't just stand for do it yourself. It also means dream it yourself. And we're here to help protect the dreams you're building. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
I like also, like, as you're going through, like you're saying, they all have their individual personalities. Then Marky comes in, and Marky's like an amazing character unto himself. But then you get Richie, the mustache one, who's got short hair, and he's in there for like a hot minute.
Well, Richie, so it's funny. So there's this like wet, sort of like teen, like this website called Famous Birthdays, where they put like the birthdays of like everyone, but like it's like mostly like TikTokers and like teeny, like that's who goes on this website, or like, you know. And so I have an entry on that thing, and under like my fun facts, it's like the one thing it says is like, he met Richie Ramone. That's all it's, because like I think when they first made it, I like had just started, like my recently on my Instagram was a picture of me. I went to like the birthday bash in New York, and Richie was there, so I got a photo with Richie. But like, it's the only fact about me. It's like he knows he met Richie Ramone.
Well, that fact would win me over, because that's the one Ramone who's always, until End of the Century came out, like he was just surrounded in so much mystery. And there was like pre-Hot Topic, pre that stuff, there was like the store in Toronto, Black Market, that would have bootleg Ramones shirts. Mm. And they had the Richie lineup, and it was always so funny.
Oh, really?
Me. Yeah, like crazy. All the lineups of like, you know, like they don't
is
have...
it like the Too Tough to Die, like
I guess that's where they must have gotten it from, because like I can't think of too many other crests that had Richie on that too.
That's so weird. Oh, it was like the crest, but it said Richie on it.
It said Richie, yeah. Oh, like it was like not the Tommy one and not my the Marky one. It's like the Richie one. It's like that's deep cut.
That's amazing. That's like when you go to, you know, like you get like a Cambodian John Varvatos, and it's John Vatalatos or whatever. Yeah.
We were on tour, and we were in, I don't think we were in Beijing. We were on the way to Beijing. We're in a smaller city in China, and I ran out of clothes, and I went to like a heavy metal head shop to buy a shirt. And I walked in, I went to the XXL section, because that was the only shirts that would come close to fitting me that were in the store. And they had like Slayer, Iron Maiden, and then this like at the time crazy obscure Canadian black metal band from Vancouver called Blasphemy. It's just like that was the only shirts they had in the store.
Amazing. I hope you have. Do you?
I bought it. Oh God, yeah. It fit me down like a baby.
Bootleg, do you have the bootleg Richie Ramone shirt?
No, I was too arrogant at that point and thought it was like some poser shit to get. Now Richie's my favorite drummer of the Ramones, right? Like, because I feel like he's got such a cool vibe. I've got a cool bootleg with him on it, like a bootleg tape.
Oh, sick. Oh, yeah, he was super chill. Yeah, it was like, you know, it was at Bowery Electric in New York, so it was like a... I just went up, asked for a picture. He was very chill, super nice about it. Yeah. Yeah.
I met Dee Dee on the street one time, just said, wow. Hey, and Johnny, as I went out for dinner with, and Joey, Marky, I've seen play a bunch of times, but never got to meet him. He played up here with the Misfits a lot. Like he would come up and do an all Ramones set with his band. And then Misfits with Michael Graves would get up and do a Misfits set. And it was, seems like a reoccurring event in Toronto for a couple of years.
You haven't had CJ on?
CJ's been on.
Oh, he has been on. Okay.
Yeah, CJ's been on too. Actually, yeah, CJ was actually on twice. The first time I recorded it and my phone crashed and I lost the recording.
Oh, shit. Damn.
And it was the worst feeling, because he brought up actually a really interesting thing that I never thought about. Like, you know, when you listen to later Ramones live records and they're so fast and Joey's words don't fit on it or anything.
Yeah.
He was like, that really bothered Joey, and he would always want Johnny to slow it down. But Johnny was too influenced by like the hardcore and the metal band or like the crossover bands.
Yeah.
And wouldn't want to slow down because he wanted to be the fastest band.
Yeah.
And it was something that like CJ would constantly talk to Joey about, because it really upset Joey. Not being able to fit the words on the music.
for an aesthetic thing, or were the shows harder too? If he's just like,
the shows are kind of harder. Like, I don't know. Like, I find it as a singer who, especially because I'm singing songs like that my guitar player writes sometimes, I find that very relatable. Like, it frustrates the shit out of me.
Yeah, totally.
Because I think your hands are always going to be able to move faster than your tongue does.
Yes, yes, yes. And like, look, not saying the Ramones lyrics were always the most intelligible to like a non fan, but like, you know, if you're writing, you wrote the lyrics for a reason and you want it to be played, and you know, I can absolutely understand that. And you put it at a certain, you recorded it a certain way for a reason, like speeding up and slowing down a little bit for the live version. Like, obviously, like, some of that happens, but if you're literally just speeding it up just to have it, you know, they didn't write a hardcore song. They wrote a Ramon song, I could imagine.
Yeah, there's that, like, I think it's on Loco Live when he's doing Blitzkrieg Bop, and it's in the chorus where he's like, Blitzkrieg Bop.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, the poor guy.
Yeah.
This must have been fucking infuriating being stuck in a band.
Well, that was the end.
Yeah, I guess like 91.
It's like a few more
years, but it never seems like it was very fun. Like, it does feel like it was a service to have to be in the Ramones. And that's why I think CJ, when he was on the show, we talked about how he probably fit in so well because he came right out of the military, like going AWOL from the military into the Ramones. So
yeah,
he was ready for something not to be fun.
Yes, but then maybe it's as I get older too, but like, I do also find myself relating more to Johnny in that way of like, we're not fucking coal miners. So like, we get to play in a rock band. So like, show up and do the fucking show and like, get it fucking done. Like, it's not a game. This is our job. We're working, like, you know. And so I do empathize with that. Like, and he was clearly the one who made it. You know, if there was anything that was not fun for everyone, I think it was Johnny leading the charge on that. But like, I can put myself in his position of like, we get to be in the Ramones. We get to play fucking rock music professionally. Like, this is our job. Like, let's fucking do it.
Yeah, it's like a really interesting kind of old world entertainment approach, like, get in the van, we got another two shows tonight, come on, like, this is the job, this is what we do.
Yeah,
versus now where it's like you're complaining on your Instagram story about how depressing it is to be on the road, and I say this as someone who's definitely in the latter more than the former camp.
No, but yeah,
it's just like a lot more emo now to be a performer.
Well, both can be true. I would say like, as I've gotten older, I've related to that perspective more of like, and you know, also it's like trying to be feel, and maybe I'm also compared to you much newer to touring. So I'm like, you know, I'm still like grateful to be able to, not saying you're not.
I think every band, much in the same way that like the world is Johnny's and Joey's, I think, not politically, but I think just like emotionally, every band needs a Johnny, and every band kind of needs a Joey too, I guess, to be, but like, you need someone who's going to be like, we got to fucking do this. And if we don't do this, and I say this as someone who's got a Johnny in my band, once again, not politically.
No, yes.
But that is constantly kind of the same way and kind of driving this thing. And I think also being a lead singer, that's why I think being a comedian, it must be, I don't know, interesting to hear your perspective on it, because I feel like being out there, being the front person of something, being audience facing, not being able to like look down on your instrument and just kind of like retreat into that, it's like being a lot more of a raw, open nerve constantly. And you're taking stuff in from people. And God, Gord Downie from the Tragically Hip told me one time, he's like, you will wear it differently being the lead singer in a band than being any other position in the band, because you're taking everything that's thrown at you and you have to wear it. And that's what it is.
Yeah. It's been really interesting, especially on this last tour I just got off of. Like, this was definitely like my biggest tour, and the way my show is now It's like I tour with a band. I used to think of my show as like a comedy show with music, and now I think of it as like a funny concert. And so it's like all standing room. It's a band. I'm playing the songs, and it's really, really interesting, like, to hear you say that, like, because, yes, like, some of the most difficult, challenging, like, vulnerable moments are, like, the comedy, hard comedy. Like, I sort of do, like, little stand-up bits in between. And, yeah, it's really weird. I mean, especially coming from now, you're catching me at this weird time where like this last tour, I had to really straddle like what my show is now, because certain things that you do instinctively, like for a comedy audience, are not the same things you do for a music audience. So for example, like with comedy, the audience is expecting to hear all new material, new, because that's what comedy is. It's like meant to like surprise them with new stuff. Whereas with a, like, especially with the stuff I do, like there with a, when you're playing a music show, like there's an expectation that people are excited to hear the stuff they heard on the record. So it's literally an opposite tension happening. So being able to, you know, because, you know, like essentially I'm playing my parody songs, but like the jokes don't hit in the way of like they're new, like you haven't heard this before. The jokes hit in the way of like, oh, he's playing the song I recognize and this is fun. And so I sort of went on a little bit of a tangent there, but like it's this new kind of like tension that I'm having to like navigate, which has been really fun, and I think something really cool and unique has come out of it. But it's definitely this weird, like sometimes literally the comedy and the music are like fighting against each other.
Yeah, it's interesting because like when Chris Gethard was on the show one time, he said that the worst crowds he's ever had to play for have been music audiences, because they're looking for a different experience than a comedy audience is going to be looking for. And to go out before the Bouncing Souls, he said the Bouncing Souls, opening for them in particular, was a really rough show, because this crowd didn't want to laugh. They wanted to be as earnest as possible and emote with the band on stage and sing along and reminisce and nostalgia. Like the relationship we have with music is kind of different than, like you're saying, the relationship you have with comedy, and with like, it feels like it's different parts of your brain being activated. So juggling the two, it's a separate art, I guess.
Totally. And that was the big, so this is the second time I've toured with a band, but like the last time the shows were split, cause I didn't know what they would be. Like half the shows were seated and half the shows were standing. And I realized the standing room shows were better, because it's like, it's a concert now. So it's like about energy and like, you know, just getting into the music in that way. Yeah, like when people are seated and prepared to like hear new jokes and hear something new, your brain is oriented in a different way. Like, so on this new tour, it was all standing room and it was great. Like, I'm just so happy with where the show is now. But then it kind of went the opposite way of like, now energy is high, but some of the comedy moments would like get lost, and like where I was expecting a laugh, I'd get like woos, you know, like, and it was like fucking with my brain to like, it's like a pendulum swinging of like, now we've swung a little too far in towards the like energy music concert sing-along thing, so I want to like swing it slightly back to like the comedy. I'm still figuring it out.
I feel like it's also like people take in live experiences different when they take in recorded experiences. Like,
yeah,
I can't watch stand up on tape or video in the same way that I could go and experience a stand up show. And I also like find that with pro wrestling, like professional wrestling, I definitely enjoy watching it on tape form, but like experiencing it live, it's a completely different sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's true with comedy too, right? Like in music as well. Comedy music as well. I feel like there's bands that I love listening to their records and I could totally listen to them for hours, but seeing them live would be a chore.
Yeah. I mean, yes. Comedy the experience, that's why I like on TikTok, a lot of people, or like on social media, a lot of people will shit on comedians for like, you know, like, how could you think this is funny? Like think about when you sit down and watch even a comedy movie alone in your room, you know, alone at home or whatever. Like, it could be your favorite comedy movie. You're not often literally laughing out loud. Like, sometimes you are, but like, I think stand up or like live comedy is like one of the hardest things you can do. And it really, really does not translate to like, because also it's like the thing of like, when you're surrounded by other people, like it's this group, and you know, it's any live thing, but I just think, you know, stand up and comedy is the thing I know best. It's like if something different happens in that room that is sort of indescribable, and it like will never fully translate to like any recorded medium.
I feel like it's also very meditative too. Like you're sitting down, you're relaxed. Like laughing is like a lot of muscles go into laughing, yeah. And to laugh standing up, I guess it's like roll on the floor laughing is where it comes from, right? Like it's hard to stand up and laugh hysterically, but when you're sitting down in that space with that sort of like group kind of experience going on, like it makes you more receptive. Yeah. Like there's like jokes that I'm sure land a trillion times better in a live room than they do at me on my toilet getting up at 5 a.m. after my kids have woken me up going like, this isn't fucking funny, like scrolling through.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's weird. I'm still navigating it after all these years. It's interesting.
But then the other thing you've navigated, which this is also very sort of like businessy type side of things, is like these platforms. Like, do you tailor the content for a TikTok versus an Instagram? Like, is there a different audience you find or different desires from the platforms?
I mean, at this point, not really. Like, I've been doing it now, like social media stuff, and for like 5 years now. And I've definitely internalized like a lot of like little things that I'll do differently just to get people interested in what I'm posting. But for the most part, no. And I still try as much as I can to not, I mean, I definitely try as hard as I can to not think about actively like, will this go viral? Like whenever I'm creating anything, because that's when you know, sort of get yourself in a trap, kind of to what we were talking about earlier. Like if you're writing something to be like, I want the cool kids to think I'm cool, like, you know, or I want people to think I'm smart, or people to think I'm hot, or people to think I'm a genius or whatever the fuck, like in the same way of like, I'm trying to actively do something that will go viral. As soon as you start to think that way, that's the surest way to not, you know, have it go viral. Or in the same way of like, if you create something being like, I want people to think I'm smart, that's how you make people look, that's how you look like an idiot. So yeah. I really try not to think about it that way. And I do, yeah, I don't really tailor one thing for TikTok or Instagram. I generally post everything across like all platforms for the most part. Now it's good because I have an audience on different platforms. I could sort of test things in one place, and if it really sucks, I'll be like, yeah, fuck it, I'm just not even gonna bother posting it. But like I try not to, you know, there are certain things I'll notice like logistically about one versus the other. So like, for example, on TikTok, like you'll know within the first hour how big it's gonna get, whereas like Instagram or YouTube, it might take a day. Like it'll like flatline, and then all of a sudden like views will go way up. So there are like little things like that I've learned over the years, but in terms of like the creative side of it, Not really. And like, it's kind of cool because, you know, I was doing live comedy and improv and the musical comedy and characters, all that stuff for many, many years before I was ever on, like, had an audience on social media. So it kind of worked out well in that, like, my style and taste with, like, doing a bunch of different characters, that was stuff you know, if you saw me in a basement in 2018, like, that's what I would have been doing. I just tailored it to a short form video platform. So I kind of got lucky in that way, in that, like, these platforms value what I, like, this style that I'd already sort of developed.
Yeah, like, they are, but, like, it's interesting how there's, like, almost like a separate, I ran into a guy that I know who does, like, mixed martial arts, like, social media stuff, this guy Robin Black, and he was telling me about, like, the art to thumbnails on YouTube that, you know, you got to get a professional to do this because there's certain thumbnails, and it's almost like on one level you're making something for an audience, but then there's, like, there's also this thing that you're having to make art to kind of get to help the platform or to get around the platform in a way, because like,
yeah
even reach that audience that you have, like, so that it'll even show up on their screens.
Yeah And it's very weird. And it's, I tried, luckily, like, what I do, I still am, like, you know, it's what I do is still very in-house and minimal. It's essentially still me with a phone. You know, I don't have a team of people helping me do all this stuff. But yeah, there is, I mean, but I think, like, sometimes that can be, you know, thumbnails or whatever, like, oh my God, did he just say that?
That's like, exactly. Yeah. I'm like, it doesn't seem like there's that much art to it.
Yeah,
like,
there. Yeah. But I would say in theory, you could imagine a world in which that could like facilitate like cool creativity, and that like these restraints has pushed people to adapt and change. But yes, in actuality, like, you know, like, old man gets kicked in head, like, he's not the most sophisticated, but yeah, it's, you know, yeah.
it's he gets way more views than I get, so do you, so that's why I'm taking it all in. I'm gonna eventually have a social media strategy just in time for them to invent a new platform for me to try and figure out.
Well, that's how it always goes. Yeah,
I saw the Costco guys. They're talking about having like overseas editing farms that edit all their footage at night. And
yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing too. Is like, to be honest, like the way if you just fart out like tons and tons and tons of content, that also can be. I met this dude once in like San Francisco, and he was like he used to work for Mr. Beast and was some crazy like genius content guy, and like he just had a team like churning out like hundreds of videos every day of like, but they would be like, you know, move the title slightly to the right, change one word about this, and they just are, it is a literal farm of like, and it's like horrible. And it was cool, he was like, this world I've gotten into is terrible, so I'm gonna like, it was like Oppenheimer. He was like trying to like undo the damage that he had created, and was like trying to create an app that like incentivized kid, like you would give kids like a little like pet on their phone, and for every hour of screen time you'd like kill the pet or something. So like but he was also still actively like, I've met, like, you know, churning out like true garbage, like, you know, like the videos that are like half Minecraft and half like whatever, like a podcast clip, and you know, just true garbage.
Those are the videos that always boggle my mind that show up on TikTok, where yeah, like it's like half someone speed running like Sonic the Hedgehog 2, and then like Joe Rogan talking about eugenics.
Yeah,
and I'm like, who's this for? And who's making it? Like, who's like, oh, I gotta see the speed run of Sonic while this guy's saying this. Like, I don't understand what it's doing. But then again, I'm maybe I'm lost. Like, maybe that's my problem.
Well, it's dark. It's like a lot of that shit comes from just dudes like literally just like churning it out all day. And then they make, you know, they monetize it. It's like a TikTok creator fund. And then also there are videos that you get doubly because TikTok now has changed it, that they incentivize, it's, you know, essentially they're trying to incentivize longer form videos, like videos over a minute. So your pay goes way up if you do videos over a minute. So they're just literally that shit is literally just trying to keep you from scrolling away as long as humanly possible. And they make more money that way. So,
So you're saying that me even watching it, trying to figure it out, is playing into the game.
Well, that's my dad. My dad will tell me, like, he, cause now I've like, you know, cause I'm online, like I've gotten my parents are like on TikTok now too. And they're like, my dad's like, oh, I see these videos of these guys, you know, going into a police department and bothering everyone. And I hate these videos. Why does it keep showing me that? I'm like, Dad, cause you're watching it and it now knows that you're getting upset and stewing in your chair, like getting upset about how much you don't want to be watching it. Like, yeah, literally.
Yeah. That's the other day when that Kanye West song leaked and I'm like, well, I got to hear it, but how do you hear it without giving someone a kickback? And that's,
yeah,
we lived in a different time. Like, even if we're talking about that very sketchy White Pride record, like there was a way for someone to engage with it, with a curiosity by taping it from somewhere or something that wouldn't necessarily give the artist a kickback. Whereas now, anytime you engage with something, even if you're just hate watching it or trying to figure it out, you're like incentivizing it for the person.
Yeah. And I think there is definitely a darkness to when, I mean, the entire entertainment, art, creator economy is just pure, if you boil it down right now, purely based on attention. Like, it doesn't matter. That's why you get like a lot more people now who are just doing like rage bait or like a good example. Like, there's a lot of videos that I'll see of people like deliberately making like a shitty recipe, like food videos where like they're deliberately doing something that's like slightly off or fucked up. And like, yes, now people will think of this person as a bad cook, but like, they don't care. All that matters is attention. It doesn't matter if it's good attention, bad attention. Literally, they can monetize your attention no matter what. And like, there was always a, you know, a bit of that. Like, you go back to Andy Kaufman and his wrestling stuff. Like, he didn't care whether people understood that he was doing a bit. And this is a much dumber version of that, obviously. But it's like the same thing is, it's like that, but times 10 and even stupider, in that like all that matters, it doesn't matter what people think of you or what you're doing. It's like all that matters is getting their attention.
Yeah, like that's the most dangerous part, I guess, about this moment is the fact that like people always did dumb stuff. Like people always did crazy things. Like Andy Kaufman, I think, would have done that wrestling bit if no one was watching. Like if you think about some of the audiences that he was doing that for, like granted, he's on The Tonight Show at sometimes, but he's also wrestling in Memphis to, you know, a few thousand people, right? And getting super injured. Yeah. And but now that's monetized. And that's the difference we think between other periods in time is like, I guess it's a post Jackass thing too, when Jackass, like there was always people taping people hurting themselves and hurting their friends, but Jackass put a name on it and called it comedy. And that was a real breakdown in society moment.
I am a Jackass fan, but
same here because love it too, but I'm saying I'm a part of the problem with society.
Well, but then also it's like, not to, you know, be snobby or whatever, but it's like you take a great idea and then people who with bad intentions or bad taste, to be honest, like get a hold of what the essence of something is. And if they're really crass, like what is, you know, what could make them money? And then they take that concept and then they, you know, distort it or you know, fuck it up. Like, and then it just becomes, you know, what made Jackass so great is like the bits were, it not only was like, it was crazy to watch, but like, and like really unique at the time, but like they were well constructed, like comedy bits, like, you know, that just happened to have the slapstick. It was like slapstick comedy, but instead of like, you know, Buster Keaton getting hit with a rake, like it was a guy getting kicked in the balls, like, you know, like, yeah. I think also it's like when quality really, like quality now to success, which essentially success now is just like whatever views, likes, whatever, it sounds corny, but like essentially that's true. Like quality is almost irrelevant. You can have a high quality viral thing, but it's not necessary at all. Like there is no, all that matters again is just keeping people's attention.
Do you, because of obviously your this, the audience you've kind of grown, like, do you get invited to these like weird meetups of influencers? Like, have you met the Costco guys or the, what was it? The Chick-fil-A person? Like, all
I have, and they're weird as fuck, and I don't go to them anymore, and I just feel weird as fuck. I haven't met them. I haven't met those people, but like, no, I mean, again, not to sound like snobby, because I do actually love, you know, to bring it back to punk. That's how I felt about, like, when I first started getting on TikTok and doing short form content. Like, I still love doing it, and I like, I don't care. I don't mind being called like a content creator or whatever, because I still love doing it. And it's still an extent, like, I have complete freedom. I don't have to answer to anybody. I can put out any idea I want and like find an audience. And that's still so cool. But like, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think of myself as like an influencer, like, and I've been to like a few of these things, and they're just like, you know, the first time someone was like, what's your hashtag strategy? I was like, Jesus fucking Christ, what am I doing here? Like, this is insane. Like, it just, yeah, I don't know. It's weird.
What percentage of it do you think at this point is like, because it is big money, like you're saying, like this is a job and a good job. What percentage of it is now people that are like big business minded, people that are doing stuff that they would be doing otherwise, like yourself, and then legitimate freaks kind of getting into the space and just finding an audience?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, I feel like I'm even one generation older than, like, because I didn't grow up, obviously, like, Facebook came out, really, and I was, like, in middle school or high school, so, like, I'm even one generation older than like these kids now who like grew up with social media and specifically like TikTok short form content. And like the idea of like, they understand it and don't give a fuck about it like way more than, so to answer your question, I think everyone who's getting into it is like big business minded and trying to make money, or at least aware of the potential of like, I could make serious money doing that. And it's weird and not great. Like, so for example, like I'm not saying this guy was cynical about anything, but it's just an example of like the difference. Like I did a video recently with this dude, Brendan Abernathy, who was like, I don't know if you saw this, like, but everyone was sort of shitting on him for having a corny, cringy song that was very earnest. And yeah. And so I have a sort of millennial Ho-Hey Stomp character.
Yeah, I only know him through your video, actually. Like, that was where I was like, oh, so okay, so now it's making a lot more sense to me. Now what's going on?
Yes. So what was happening was, like, he had this song that everyone was sort of clowning on him, and, like, I have a character that's sort of a parody of, like, a 2010s Ho-Hey Stomp Clap character. So as soon as this video came out, everyone was hitting me up to be like, dude, you gotta fucking clown on this guy, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, that feels really corny, like, because A, he's just some guy. He's not, you know, he's not Mumford and Sons. He's not playing Madison Square Garden. He's yeah. like a fucking dude in who knows where. And now everyone is laughing at his, like, super earnest song. And, like, it just felt like me taking advantage if I'm just gonna, like, do a really low-hanging fruit. So I hit him up. I was like, hey, you know, if you're it's like, if you're not interested, I'm not going to do anything. But if you want, like, people are saying that your song is similar to my character. If you wanted to do something, I think I was only going to do it if he wanted to be part of it. And he was like down. And then I got on the phone with him and I was like, I've been through this moment before. Like, I was trying to, like, you know, I was like, don't like make like, try to make him feel better about this really scary, crazy moment when the whole world is, like, giving you attention and not all of it's great. And he was like, and he's younger than me. He's like, oh yeah, no, it's not a problem. Like, I love all the attention. And he'd been trying to, like, he'd been a musician for many, many, many years. And I feel like that is a generational thing of, like, he's like, oh yeah. Like, I'm sure he didn't love it, but, like, he was, like, psyched that people were paying attention to his music and understood that, like, attention economy better than I ever could. Like, he was just like, no, this is an opportunity for me, which is scary in a way, but also, like, cool that that generation understands how this system all works, like, better than even me. Like, he was like, yeah, he's like, no, let's, yeah, just, yeah, whatever you want to do, like, let's do it.
It's interesting because, like, I've got three kids, and two are preteen and one's a teen. One's actually just about to turn teen too. And they're all very much engaged with social media, but not making it anymore, which I feel like the generations before were very much like, I'm going to put myself out there. Like, here yeah. I am. And now the people that are doing that are, like you're saying, like, it's a strategy, or it's like part of a plan a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It's like the cliche from, like, 2012 of, like, what do I care if you post your sandwich on Facebook? Like, that doesn't really exist no. anymore. Like, yeah. Like, no one would talk about it that way. Yeah. It's really interesting. And I even, you know, I have some, like, cousins who are in, like, high school, and yeah, it's like you're saying, like, it's a very clear generational difference.
Yeah, like, it's now very much a broadcast medium as opposed to a interactive medium, I find.
Yeah, and for better or worse, and, like, I feel like people have, you know, started to talk about it, but it's like, to that generation, like, this is TV. Mm-hmm. This is, like, that is, and it's just happens to be, like, user generated rather than from a studio or something like that. But, like, it's TV. It's TV to them. And there are pros and cons to that, but it is just the way it is now.
Yeah. And it's also, it's interesting how generational platforms can become too. Like, I find Instagram slightly older, and I find, like, stuff will break on TikTok, make its way to Instagram, and eventually show up on YouTube stories is like,
yeah.
And then my youngest kid who only watched YouTube, and then my middle child who was very much into TikTok, like, they would be aware of things kind of at different times because they were breaking.
Totally. It's, and yes, to go back to your question that you were asking earlier about, like, stuff I've noticed, because now the fact that now I do have an audience on all these different platforms, there is definitely, like, so for example, at my shows, like, some of them are, not all of them are all ages. And, like, even back, so, you know, I started, like, really touring after I had, like, developed an audience on social media, like, maybe 2021 or two. And back then, like, I had a big following on TikTok, but I didn't really have a big following anywhere else. But like, people would come to shows and they'd be like, even more than a higher ratio than you'd think, to be like, oh, I saw you on Instagram, because those are the people who can come to my shows, like, our people, you know, like, and it's even, I mean, now I have sort of an audience everywhere, so it's not always the same, but like, I still think, like, it's definitely true. It's like slightly older on Instagram. And the other thing that's really interesting, so like, the most, like, so I had the Planet of the Bass Eurodance song that like blew up last summer, and I had a decent sized audience on Instagram, and a big audience on TikTok, but I essentially had no following on Twitter at all. Like, I never was a big Twitter person, and that song really blew up on Twitter, and it became like a mainstream press thing because all the journalists are on Twitter, and but they would call it, they would say, oh, the TikTok phenomenon, TikTok, but it was more on Twitter than it ever was on any of the other things. But like, they wanted to say that it was a TikTok phenomenon when really it was a Twitter phenomenon. And the only reason that journalists knew about it or cared about it was because it was on the platform that they pay attention to, which was Twitter.
Yeah, like, I had the lead singer of Acid Bath on the podcast, and it is by far my most listened to episode on YouTube.
Really?
And comments every time, like, you know, the stories I put up from it, which are very modest, but it's completely average on every other, like, I would say even not one of the lesser listened to episodes on like some of the other streaming platforms. But this band Acid Bath was rediscovered by YouTube people and has become like this sort of like YouTube, they're an amazing wow. band obviously, but like they've got this sort of like rediscovery on YouTube thing over other places. And it's, yeah, like, I've heard about some other bands that like, my friend Sergi was on from Sam I Am and was telling me about some band that had a Numero Group reissue and blew up on Spotify. And so now they've got these giant sold out shows, but if you were around during the time, you'd never would have heard of this band necessarily. Or if you're maybe not even on Spotify, you might not even know who this band is, but they're ginormous on there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's so interesting too. Cause like, I paid like, you know, bands that will have huge, and like, there are a lot of things that go into streaming weirdness, like playlisting and all that stuff. But like, you know, yeah, they'll have really high monthly listeners, but then they don't have a large like social media following, which is also like, I guess that's good because like, it's people who are coming out to the shows, like, you know, selling, like, they're actually just care about the music. So like, that is like kind of a good sign, like the opposite of what you'd think, that you can sort of just develop a following on Spotify where people are just listening to the music and sort of the other shit doesn't really matter as much. But yeah, it really depends. It can often like be different, like platform by platform, like the audiences on there is different, the like type of stuff they like to consume is different, the behavior is all different. It's weird.
Well, Kyle, anytime you want to come on here, talk about the Ramones, give me advice on my social media strategy or my hashtag strategy or anything else, you're yeah. always welcome.
100%. I'll bring Richie next time and then we'll all hang out.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.